all help me welcome our speaker tonight, Steve from the Hartsville Morning Group.
Yeah, I'm Steve, alcoholic. Can everybody hear me okay? So, I don't know, I'll start. My sobriety date is February 5th, 2012. I do have a sponsor, and my sponsor is a sponsor, and I do have a home group. And I don't know, the first guy who sponsored me told me that's important to say that every time I speak, right? What your sobriety date is, and that you have a sponsor and a home group. And, you know, I know for me, that's the first time I got humbled when I was asked, when I asked another man to sponsor me. So I was joking earlier, this is the first time I ever spoke for an hour, so I don't know, we'll try to go an hour. I don't know if I'll make it. And I'm going to be right up front. I go to a Saturday morning group and they talk about, you know, you're in the program and know you're doing 12-step work when you have inconvenient service, right? And inconvenient service is tonight. I heard some guys talking about the Sixers, and I'm up here telling my story when the game is on. So when I'm looking down, you might think I'm checking the clock. I'm actually checking the score. So I'll just try to keep it within the hour before I get on a roll. But thank you for having me. This is a great setup. I mean, water, microphone, professional. Listen, I don't have a great drunk log. I don't have a some spectacular story. I was garden variety, fall down, blackout drunk. No rehab. I'm a walk-in, right? I walked into a meeting for the first time with a very, very good friend of mine. So I'll try to keep it, you know, try to keep it in some type of order. But no reason to be an alcoholic. Grew up Northeast Philly, a little neighborhood called Ronhurst. One of six. Nobody in my immediate family is an alcoholic. There's plenty of alcoholism all over my extended family, aunts, uncles, cousins. But in my home, nobody. You know, my parents, as I look back, probably found each other because everybody else in their families were pretty heavy drinkers, right? And they kind of moved away from them, too. You know how it is in Philly. Everybody, all the cousins lived in one neighborhood. We didn't. We moved up a little bit further than everybody else. And I think that, and looking back, you know, I didn't know at the time, but looking back, I think they had an intent when they did that to keep us away from that. But, I'm like I said, I'm textbook, right? I had feelings of insecurity and fear from a very, very young age, right? And, you know, I didn't even know it at the time. The longer I get sober, the more it comes into focus, but just like silly stuff, right? So like, I don't know. We hung out in the schoolyard where I grew up, right? And I was a kid who wanted to be with the cool guys, but I knew from a very young age the difference between right and wrong. And when I was 9, 10, 11, 12 years old and we were just doing goofy stuff as kids in the schoolyard and they did stuff they weren't supposed to be doing, I was too fearful to do it, right? The second part of that was, though, I was also too fearful to tell them to stop, right? Like, I couldn't stand up to them either, right? I didn't have the car, or 42, whatever you want to call it, right? But I wasn't telling anybody to stop, right? But I also didn't want to do it. And, you know, that carried with me, you know? That carried with me. Fear dominated me as a child. You know, another example of that, I mean, this is pretty funny. I have a brother who's 10 years older than me, and he used to coach us in sports. And, that'd be the luck of the Irish. Me getting struck by lightning at an AA meeting. Right? That'd be alcoholic and Irish. So he was 10 years older, and like he was mid-20s, and or 21, 22, and he would coach us, and sometimes if there was a snowstorm or rain like this, and we had to cancel practice, he would call like five or six people, and then he'd be like, all right, I'm going out. You call the rest of the kids on the list, right? And this was like fifth, sixth grade. I was pretty well liked. I came from a family that was pretty normal in the neighborhood. Like, we weren't known as the crazy family. And I was scared to death to make those phone calls. Like, I thought I was imposing on those people's lives, right? Like, I thought I was going to call at dinner and they were going to be all angry, right? And look, I mean, I'm a dad now, right? When a coach calls and tells you no practice, everybody in the house is happy, right? Like, the kid's happy, the dad's happy, the mom's happy, right? And I was scared to death to make those phone calls. Like, what happens if their mom picks up? What happens if they pick up? What, God forbid, their sister picks up, right? The older sister, then I'm really screwed. And that stayed with me, man. I'm afraid of people. I'm afraid of women. I'm afraid of standing up for myself. And I didn't know any of that as a kid, right? I was just going through life. I was just clueless. So, like a lot of kids my age, I wanted to be like my older brother. And I wanted to be like the guys he hung out with, right? And what I saw through my eyes was kids in the schoolyard playing sports and drinking beer, right? And as I got older, they were doing a lot more than that. But that's what I saw as a little kid. And I wanted to do that. And, you know, I was out, you know, I was hanging out and, you know, somebody gave me whatever. It was probably a quart back then, you know what I mean? If anybody drank quarts out of the paper bags, and I'm showing my age. And all those fears went away, man. All those fears went away, you know, really quickly they went away. And I drank alcoholically from the first time. That wasn't my first drunk. That was like my first drink. My first drunk was with two good friends of mine. We split a case of beer, and I drank alcoholically that first night, right? I drank to blackout. I came home. We had bunk beds. I threw up all over my younger brother, which was foreshadowing because he, like, had to not take care of me, right? But he always watched out for me for the next 20 years of his life. And the funny part is my drinking never really, it's a progressive disease, and I think it progressed in many ways, but I pretty much drank the same way my whole life. Like, I was a blackout binge drinker my whole life. Like, I never became a daily drinker. And that baffled me for a lot of years, you know, because I had the ability to stop. I had the ability to stop, and if I could stop, I was an alcoholic, right? If I could not drink for a few days, a week, 10 days, you know, to me, I was an alcoholic, right? I had no idea what alcoholism was other than, you know, the drunk guys on the corner standing outside the bar trying to get a quart or trying to get, you know, whatever, to get through their day. And it just kept going like that, right? Like, so that was my drinking, like, my whole life. And I had consequences early. And nothing serious because where I grew up and how I grew up, there's always somebody, like, getting me out of a little bit of trouble. But, like, underage drinking, you know, like, little stuff like that was always happening. And then I knew very early I drank different than all my friends, right? And I didn't drink with any teetotalers, right? I drank with hard drinkers. Like, the requirement to be our friend was to live in our neighborhood, show up at the schoolyard, get really, really drunk, and come back the next day. If you did that, you were with us, right? And because plenty of our friends came, and they didn't come back another time, right? So I was with hard drinkers, and I always had this internal urge to stop drinking. I know a lot of people don't have that, but I had it, and I had it really, really, really young. Like, I knew I shouldn't be drinking. But anyhow, I just kept drinking, and then I had plenty of emotional, you know, frothy emotional appeals. And the first one I remember was, you know, I went to high school, and I played basketball, and I was pretty good, and I didn't drink like other kids. And my coach, who coached at that school for a long time, and I certainly was not the first drunk he coached, right? Like, he there's a lot of kids, right? Like, plenty of kids are drunk. He pulled me aside over Christmas, and he told me, he said, I'll never forget, he said, Steve, I know everybody on the basketball team drinks. I know you guys party. He said, some people can't drink. And that was my first attempt to stop drinking. Like, I looked him right in the eye, and I said, you know what? I won't drink the rest of the season. Like, I won't drink from now till March, right? And I meant it in that moment. I meant it with all my, there was nothing more important in my life at that moment. Nothing, right? It was like basketball, girls, right? That was it. I was 17 years old, and I didn't make it a week, right? So I was drinking, you know, I was drinking very quickly after that. And that was the first person I remember. And the only reason I use that story is because you fast forward, you know, I got my girlfriend pregnant at a pretty young age. So, but I was, you know, I was a father by age 20, 21. And You know, I was the type of drinker. If my 5-year-old daughter, she's a beautiful girl, she just got married this summer, and she's a beautiful little kid, but if she was standing at the doorway crying, saying, "Dad, don't go out tonight," like, I was stepping over, like, right? I was going over her, and I would deal with her the next day. So that story sticks in my head now that I'm sober, just because, like I said, fast forward, right? 3-4 years later, it was my daughter's wife, or my daughter's mother, my wife. It was my daughter. It was an employer. It was whoever, right? Like, I just kept drinking, and people kept asking me to stop, you know? And, you know, I couldn't stop. And I think that's in the big book, right? Part of the big book, it says, you know, have people asked you to stop, right? And people definitely asked me to stop. And I couldn't stop. So, I mean, you know, that's how I drank. And that, like I say, like, I'm a garden variety drunk. You, all you have to do is go to doctor's opinion, right? The paragraph that starts out that I drink for effect, right? We drink for effect, and it continues on, you know, and says I go through a spree and I pick up again, I do it again, and it's a vicious cycle of insanity. That's me. There's nothing spectacular about it. I racked up the trophies, DUIs, I have 2 ex-wives, 5 kids, you know, you name it. I have it, right? And I was baffled and I was clueless why all this kept happening to me. Like I said, I always had the ability to stop drinking. I always wanted to stop drinking, right? But in between those bouts, from however long it went, 7 days, 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever amount of time I made, I always suffered from being restless, irritable, and discontent. And no matter how long I could stop drinking, and no matter what the reason I could stop drinking, I'd build up like a dam, right? And that moment would come, and I have that, you know, mental twist, and I'd pick up, and I'd be off again. And no amount of, I can't recall, right? I cannot recall my last drunk, right? I cannot recall my last drunk. And the other thing that happened to me a lot, and I know people drink differently. My best friend in the program says he always wanted to get completely annihilated. Right? And that was not my experience, right? Like, I'm the guy in the book who I want to drink like a normal person, right? So in those bouts of sobriety, right, of dryness, because I wasn't sober, of being a dry drunk, my brain was constantly telling me, next time will be different, right? I was the guy chasing, wanting to drink like a normal person, and I could never do it, you know? I could never do it. You know, I'm the guy who wants to be 6 Budweisers, 4 shots of vodka, and then just stay there all night, you know what I mean? And I can never do it, right? I want permanent buzz, and I can't do it. And I repeated that over and over. I always overshot the mark, and it played out a lot of different ways. I remember my younger brother, who I mentioned, I kind of tormented him for 20-some years. He was getting married, and I was the best man. It was the night before the wedding, and this was not the bachelor party, it was not the rehearsal dinner, this was the night before the wedding, just some guys in the wedding party were getting together at the local bar, and going to have some drinks, going to show up the next day at my parents' house, pre-game for the wedding like we did, right, go to the wedding, and enjoy yourself. And I walked into the bar that night, and I had no intention of ruining my brother's wedding, right? That is not my intention when I walk through those doors of the Ronhurst Cafe, right? It is not my intention. I sit down, I have a couple drinks, everybody's having a couple drinks, they're all having a good time. Again, they're all hard drinkers. Like, I couldn't decide, like, my friends are hard. Like, 3 of my friends, one died of drank himself to death at 40 about a few years ago. And 2 of them were found dead in Kensington in their 40s. Like, these were not, like, teetotalers that we were with in this wedding. All 3 of them were in the wedding party, right? And but then there were some other guys. And most of the guys went home. And, you know, how I drink, I ended up in Camden that night. And came to in Camden the next day. And it was right at the start of cell phones. And I was with this woman, girl at the time, and I'm like handing her cell phone, and I'm telling her to call my older brother and tell him that I can't show up, that he's best man now. That was my best thinking. I'm like, Call him and tell him he's the best man today. I'm not the best man. So then he's in a panic, right? And again, this is early cell phones. And now he's trying to call all the guys at the bar. And he's calling the drunks first, saying, where the hell were you guys? And they're like, we left them at like 12 o'clock or whatever, right? Because nobody wanted to be with me by that point. And my best thinking was that day was, don't go to your parents' house. Because if you start drinking at 11 a.m. or 10 a.m. or whatever, you're going to be blackout drunk and ruin the wedding, right? So I volunteered my older brother to be best man. I stayed at this woman's apartment until like 12:30. I jumped in my car, I flew up I-95, and I walked into the church at like 5 minutes before the wedding and acted like nothing happened. My daughter that I told you was a flower girl, she was bawling her eyes out. My, I don't know what she was at the time, ex-wife, partner, she was there. She was not happy. She was bawling her eyes out. You know, get into the vestibule, and it's like a free-for-all. Four groomsmen are holding my brother back. He's swinging over top, trying to punch me in the head. And but that's what I do when I drink, right? And I would never, ever, ever. Well, I might do it to my brother. I would never do it to my sister-in-law, right? Like, she's a wonderful girl. But anyhow, I would never do that, right? That was not my intent. And I just always missed the mark, you know? Always missed the mark. And that started very, very young as well. You know, that started very, very young. I couldn't stop drinking once I started drinking. And it took me a long time, even in AA, to understand that, you know, there's only two requirements, right? I tried to stop drinking entirely. I answered that yes, and I couldn't stay stopped. I could not stay stopped. And then once I pick up, the phenomenon, you know, a craving kicks in, the allergy kicks in, and I don't stop till whenever I stop. And the baffling part is there was nights I only drank whatever, like a normal person. Maybe I woke up and knew where I was and had my phone and went through the phone and it was all right and all that good stuff. But too many times I overshot the mark, right? And I just have, you know, I drank for 30 years. I have so much research, right? So much research that that I can't drink like a normal person. Now I'm different, you know. My mind's different and my body's different. And, you know, I just had to come to accept that. So, you know, I ripped through some lives. Another big, big character defect of mine is pride. Right, I'm always managing my image. I'm always managing, you know, what others think of me. If you look at my fourth step, it's all about grandiosity, pride. You know, I have delusional thoughts of what I'm supposed to be in this world and what other people think I am in this world. And I believe them. And I act on them all the time, right? And in sobriety, I act on them. And that's, you know, that's really, really what I do. So I had this problem managing, you know, managing this image of mine from a young, very young age as well. And I did that throughout my adulthood, and it caused me a lot of problems, right? So, and I don't know it, right? Like I mentioned, I got my first wife pregnant when we were 20, and again, here's my alcoholic thinking. Anybody who gets their girlfriend pregnant and doesn't marry them is a scumbag loser, right? That's my thinking. And my alcohol is telling me, marry your Steve, buy a house, and you'll be just like your dad, right? Who was a good man and married, like my parents were married 65 years, right? So, well, I do that and I take her hostage and I ruin her life. I have another child with her, I ruin their lives. And like all of that because I thought if I was walking around my neighborhood, people would be saying, there goes Steve, and he didn't marry his girlfriend, right? Like, that's my delusional thinking. So anyhow, I kept running through life. Like I said, I racked up all the trophies. Ended up getting married a second time and, you know, ended up adopting some children. So I have three adopted boys. And what ended up happening was that went south. And somebody did to me, right, somebody was selfish and self-centered and did to me what I've been doing to every relationship I was in my entire life, right? Male or female, right? Like if it was a friend, I would do it to him, or if it was a girlfriend, I would do it to him. And for the first time, I started drinking at somebody. Like, I never drank at somebody. I drank because that's what I did. Or I didn't have a whole lot of resentments. Like I said, I don't have a whole lot of family resentments. Now I had a really good reason to drink. And if you're around me, you found out about it, right? So I was more than happy to tell everybody why I was drinking. So it started to get a little bit, it started to get pretty bad. I moved down to Philly to kind of get away from everything. I was drinking down there. And then I went out on a, so two things happened. First, around New Year's Eve, I think maybe 2010 or 2011, I went on a bad run. And I woke up, and I don't know if I had alcohol poisoning or not or whatever, but I was in bed for like 3 or 4 days. And I came out of it, and my best friend from childhood had been sober at that time around 8 years. And I reached out to him when I was in really bad shape, and I asked him, I said, yo, I got to go to a meeting. And he laughed at me, hung up the phone. And I called him like 4 days later when I finally came to, and he's like, I'm like, dude, I want to go to the meeting. And he's like, are you serious? And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, why are you so, like, you know, baffled? And he's like, Steve, I've known you since you're 14. You've been doing this since you're 14, and once you get up, right, feel good, I forget all about it, and I just start drinking again. So he took me to Glenside. I went to the first meeting there. I immediately identified out. I had all these different reasons why I still wasn't an alcoholic. And then I kept drinking, moved down to Philly, started to go to some meetings, and they started to plant the seed, but I was the typical guy. Like, I came in the back. I didn't participate. I didn't raise my hand. I was still better than everybody in that room. And I just kept drinking. I don't even call it relapses because I heard it during Zoom, during the quarantine. A woman called into the Zoom meeting I used to go to, and she was from London. And she told her story, and she called it loitering with the intent to recover. And I thought that was a great line. And that's what I was doing down there. And I would get 10 days, 20 days. It was exactly the same as my life, right? I would just, whatever. So I don't even call it relapses. But I was in the rooms. I started hearing the message. And so what happened is, this is a good story. I went out on I had like 10 or 15 days. I go on a Match.com date. And it started going sideways quick. And I was in this nice restaurant. Because that's what I like to do. I like to start in a nice restaurant. And then if anybody knows Center City, I'm in Oscars at with my people. I don't know if anybody's, I know we're getting pretty, but anybody not, it's the darkest bar in Philly. Like, I'm in there, right? Like, that's my spot. And so it started off, and it was going sideways, and the waitress walked by with chocolate martinis. I never had a martini in my life, but I love chocolate. So I'm like, what is that? And she's like, it's a chocolate martini. So I had one. And then something weird happened. I got rid of the date, and I was walking up Chestnut Street, right? And I was living in Fairmount, so I had to make a right on like 20th to go towards Fairmount. And I got to Rittenhouse Square. And this is a good alcoholic story. I've been going to these Center City meetings at 7:30, and this woman, and I have a dog, so don't take this the wrong way. I own a dog. And this woman used to bring her two little dogs to the meetings in the morning, right? And I'm walking up, and there's this woman on the corner of Rittenhouse with her two dogs. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, I hate those dogs, right? And I made a left and went to the bars there on Rittenhouse Square, right, rather than going right. And, you know, it wasn't even a bad night. It was just like, I don't know what happened. It was a moment of clarity. I came to the next day in, well, I guess it was all right. It came to 2 in the next day in Southwest Philly. And I got in a cab. I was crying. And I had one phone number. I had this guy, Brandon. Phone number from the 7:30 a.m. meeting, Sunrise Semester, I used to go to, and I reached out to Brandon. I said, hey, I know who your sponsor is, and Brandon said, yeah, it's Rick, and I said, yeah, I had his number, and I reached out to Rick, and then he said, I called him, and Rick got sober 26, he's like 50-something now, he's like 20 years sober. He'd gone to the Sunrise meeting his whole sober life, like just great sobriety. So I call Rick, and he's like, who are you? And of course, I'm an alcoholic. I'm thinking, what do you mean, who am I? I'm the guy who comes in the back and sits there. Like, you should know me. And he didn't. And then he's like, he's a little old school. He's like, so you're the asshole who brings in the backpack every morning. I'm like, yeah. And he's like, you're the asshole who sits in the back, right? I'm like, yeah. He's your asshole who's never raised his hand all the times I've seen him in a meeting. I'm like, yeah. And, but I asked him to sponsor me. And, you know, I think that's the first time I ever asked anybody to sponsor me. I mean, I ever asked anybody for help, right? And it was a humbling experience. I'm still not good at asking for help. Like, I joke all the time, like, even in sobriety, it goes all the way back to when I was a kid and thought I was imposing when I was calling for basketball, like, practice. Like, I've been renting my place for the last 7 years. I'm a good tenant, right? I pay all the time. This is no lie. Like, 2 years ago, it was like one of those 100-degree days, and the air conditioner broke, right? And because I was so afraid to call the landlord to come, I called an air-conditioned place myself, right? Had them coming over, right? The guy's in the house ready to fix it, and I go, I don't own the place. And he's like, dude, I can't work on the central air if you don't own the place. You, like, got to call the landlord. I was, like, ready to pay him and everything. And sure enough, I called the landlord. She's a wonderful woman. She came over, put in a whole new unit, bigger, better. But that's how I think. So that first moment, or that day, I feel like there was a little bit of humility, right? And I've been sober ever since that day, and I don't know how that works, right? Like, I don't know how that works. But Rick was really good for me at the time. He was old school. He kind of knew what I needed. You know, he made me do a 4-step on my ex-wife immediately because I was so angry and so bitter and so consumed with what had happened. It became my story. Like, that was my whole life. And so I started going through steps with Rick, and it was a good experience. And I ended up moving back up to Bucks County to be closer to my kids. And I kept Rick as a sponsor, but I started going to Fog Lifters in Solbury, which is a group that's over in Solbury, PA. And that's kind of where I really got sober. I met some really good men. They're still my best friends in sobriety today. They did a step study group, and a bunch of us did a step study group. And, yeah, like I said, it was great fellowship. I was working the program. I was being of service, at least I thought I was being of service, by chairing meetings and doing things like that, helping some people. But I really wasn't all in the program, right? Like, I treated AA like I tried to treat it the rest of my life, right? I'm selfish and self-centered, and I was here to get sobriety and go home, right? Like, I was taking. I never raise my hand. I never share, you know, and I stayed sober, you know, I stayed sober through some tough times. I was out of work. I had to be back in with my ex-wife under the same roof. That was horrible. And, so it got me through. But, I cruised from about year 2 to about year 6, and I was miserable. I was totally miserable, right? So I was, you know, they call it untreated alcoholism, or they just call it alcoholism. Somebody just told me there is no untreated alcoholism in the big book. So I was living in alcoholism without a drink. And it finally dawned on me, you know, like, I'm a real alcoholic. So you hear in meetings a lot of times, you put down the drink and life gets better. That was not my experience, right? I put down a drink and my consequences got better, right? Like, I knew where my car was in the morning. I never came to in the roundhouse in Center City, but I got worse. Like, you took away my solution and I got worse, right? So I go to a Saturday night meeting, big book meeting, and the guy likes to say, I stop drinking, I get the bedevilments. That's what I get. I don't get, like, when I go to a meeting and somebody says, oh, I put down a drink, I'm happy, 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 I'm like, that wasn't my experience, right? My character defects dominated me in sobriety, right? I could act out so many. I tell people now, you work from home, right? If there's like a Google camera in my house, right? And you see how many times during the day I take back my will, right? And I think human aid is going to get me out of whatever I'm going through, as I'm on Amazon and ESPN and a dating app and worse stuff, right? Or watch me eat a bowl of ice cream at night. I'm not always okay in my own skin, even sober. So I'm going through it, and I was in a lot of pain, and my ego was really beating me up, and I was dominated. And so what happened was I ended up with custody of all three of these adopted boys, and about 2 years ago, or 3 years ago now. And I was in my first relationship in sobriety, and the relationship ended, and I had these three boys I was now raising by myself, and the girl broke up with me, and like I thought it was the end of the world, right? It was a typical end of the world scenario. Like it was my first relationship, like adult relationship. And so I was literally like suicidal, right? Like I got so beat up, I was suicidal. I took the boys to the, they're twins, and then there's an old, my other son's 20, so at the time they were younger. So I took the twins to the bus stop for school, and I came home, and I went upstairs, and I had this closet, and I went in the closet, and I turned off all the lights, and I was just like laying in this dark room, right? Like, you know, Googling, you know, I'm a wimp, I'm an alcoholic, so I was Googling like the easiest, softest way to commit suicide. And right, because I don't have the courage, you know, I don't have the courage. And so I was just in a really bad place. And, you know, this program meets you wherever you're at. And a good friend of mine who spoke here a couple times, Patrick, right? So Patrick was, I don't know if he's on here, but Patrick was, he used to come to Soulberry meeting, man. I thought he knew this program in and out. Right? Like he had been in and out of the program for a long time, and he'd come to the Soulberry meeting, and if he was ready to drink, he'd say, man, I've been out in the parking lot since 5:30 a.m. and I'm dying to drink. And I used to think, wow, that guy really has it, right? And I didn't know that he was in pain and he would drink. So Patrick went away and he came back into a meeting, and I hadn't talked to him in a long time, and I didn't know where he was. I thought he was out on a run, and we're at the Soulberry meeting, and this guy shared. And I hear him share, and I'm like, that sounds like Patrick, but like the anger and the, not the anger, but the intensity wasn't in his voice. And I turned around, I looked at him, and he looked like a totally different person. And, you know, I went up to him afterwards, I said, what's going on? And, you know, he told me he started going to this big book meeting, and somebody took him through the steps, and he had an experience. And, like I wanted what he had at that moment. And, so I reached out to him, and he helped me along, and then he passed me on to his sponsor, Ben. I went back through the steps, like 6 years sober. And, you know, I was honest as I could be. And you know, it's humiliating in sobriety, right, to go through the steps, go through your fourth step. And this woman who I thought did me wrong by dumping me, we listed it down on my fourth step. And I'll never forget, I was full of the self-pity and self-loathing and all the things that you are. And, Ben looked at me and he goes, you're with her for like 15 months, right? And I said, yeah. And he's like, look at all the stuff you were doing, right? Because I was pulling every dope fiend move you could pull in sobriety, right? Like in that relationship. And so he's like listening to it all, and he's like, you know, looks to me like she really liked you. Like, how could you stick around for 15 months when you're doing all this stuff, you know? And, you know, I really got a picture of, I can be the same person sober or drunk, right? I could be the same selfish, self-centered person sober or drunk. You know, I joke all the time, guys, the Saturday morning meeting, I just stole his line, right? Ask yourself, you know, are you pulling dope fiend moves in sobriety, right? Are you bumming a cigarette when you have a pack, right? Are you in a relationship or somebody thinks you're in a relationship and you're texting the girl from the meeting, right? Like, you know, I was doing some of that. And I can do all of that as a sober man. And, you know, that's really when I started to have a change. So I did the fourth step with him. And then I couldn't do my fifth step. He came over New Year's Eve. I couldn't do my fifth step New Year's Eve I did my fifth step New Year's Eve, but I couldn't take an hour to get quiet because my kids started getting a little crazy. So he said, don't worry about it. He said, tomorrow morning, take an hour, get quiet, go back, do the work that you're supposed to do, right? Check to see if you've done everything you can. And I did that. And I guess it's the closest I had to any type of experience, like physical experience. I sat down, I did that, and I just started bawling, crying. Like, I was so heavy, right? So heavy. And I stopped crying, I sat and got quiet again, and then it happened again, like a second time. And I just felt much, much lighter after that. But again, you know, being sober for a minute, going through this program and doing it, spiritual experiences can be just as fleeting as, like, sobriety, right? Like, that doesn't last forever, right? That was a wonderful moment. I felt much lighter. I felt much different. But, like, you know, 10 minutes later, I was ready to kill my kids, right? They came down and started bothering me, right? So it's like, you know, you gotta keep moving forward. And so from there, the other thing I didn't really do the first time I went through the steps, I really didn't make direct amends to everyone, right? So I had to start that amends process. And for me, that was a big, big deal. You know, I got to make amends to my parents, and that was a big deal. My mother was starting in on dementia, and it was nice. I went over, I made my amends, and, like, again, I'm an alcoholic, so I'm thinking this is the perfect time to do it. She won't remember anything, right? Like, she doesn't even know my name. Like, I got it, right? Like, and sure enough, I left there. And my older sister called me. And my older sister has been begging me to go AA since I was 18. And I just told her, I don't need religion. I don't need a big, like, contempt prior to investigation, right? And she calls me. She's like, what did you just do? And I'm like, what do you mean, what did I just do? And she's like, Mom just called me. I'm like, okay. So she called me. She said, well, whatever she did, she was crying. And she was saying how nice it was for you to take the time to apologize to your dad and me, right? God bless my mother, she passed, but, like, my mom doesn't cry, like, ever. So it was a nice experience, and I started to get to make those direct amends, and things started to change, you know, but it's progress, not perfection. I'm not perfect, but at least now I feel like I'm working the program, like I'm in it. And since then, you know, I've been blessed. Like, you know, Ben has sent me men to sponsor. Recently, over the quarantine, just some weird stuff has been happening. Like, a very good friend of mine from that group up at Soulberry texts me, and he's like, yo, I've been going to this Zoom meeting. It's really good. Jump on. And I jump on the Zoom meeting, and it's the Fairmount Clubhouse where I first got sober having the Zoom meeting. And my first sponsor, Rick, is there, and, on Zoom. And so that carried me through some of the COVID or some of the quarantine. And then I like in-person meetings. Zoom was great, but I prefer to be in person. And I found this little group in Hartsville. You know, it's a fairly new clubhouse. I went to the 6:30 meeting. It was a little bit of a scene at 6:30 p.m. And somebody said there was a real small group in the morning at 7:30. So I went there at 7:30, and I love it. I've shared more in that meeting over the last 6 months than I shared in 8 years, right? Because I don't share. Like, I'm the guy sitting there thinking of what I'm going to say, right? Because I got to be brilliant and then never share. And so I share, and some of the things are coming true. You know, some of the things are happening. Like, a couple men have asked me to sponsor them. So right now I have two sponsees, you know. I chair that meeting on Sunday mornings, or at least I try to do it. They just started doing it on the weekends. And then I still try to mix in my Saturday morning big book meeting in Doylestown, which I think is one of the best meetings around. If you're looking for a meeting, you're not far. That's one of the best meetings around. And that meeting always keeps me in check, right? Because they always punch me in the face with my sobriety, right? Like, they like to say, you know, you can check your sobriety. You want to check your sobriety? Ask yourself how many fifth steps you've heard in the last few months, right? And I'm the type of guy that didn't hear any fifth steps for, 5 years, you know? And they'll ask you, you know, do you want to get in the game or do you want to sit on the sidelines, you know? And I sat on the sidelines for 5 years. And so I guess I'm starting to get some of those promises, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. I'm a little bit of a slow teach, so it took me a long time. But listen, I'm still, right, I can still be driven by all those character defects, like, every day, right? So I need to wake up. I need prayer. I need meditation. I love the 7:30 morning meeting to set me on my agenda, you know, to kind of set my day, because throughout the day, you know, I'll take back my will at any time, right? I'll take back my will at any time. And I have a good relationship with my higher power, but trust me, self-will, right? Agnostic. And I was telling Shay earlier, I just bought a home. Like, watch me up at night worrying. I'm agnostic if I'm up worrying all night about my finances, right? You know, and it's funny because Rick used to tell me all the time, my first sponsor used to tell me all the time is, you know, promises don't say, you know, you'll be relieved of financial insecure, right? It says like the fear will be removed, right? It doesn't say you're going to be financially secure, which is what I want. And I am. I'm blessed. I am. But, you know, I want to be more financially secure. So, you know, it's been a wonderful experience. And I'll finish up with this because it's getting a little bit late. You know, the other thing they say at my Saturday morning meeting is you got to do the work, right? So the work is done when you need it, right? And I experienced that this past year. So I mentioned those twin boys, right? And while they can be so loving, they have some real issues, right? So when COVID hit, they went off the rails. They went totally off the rails. And it ended up with, they jumped a kid, they're 14 years old, they found an 18-year-old, they were smoking and drinking for like a week straight. They didn't come home for 3 days. And they jumped their friend, and they jumped him, the 18-year-old had a knife, and they jumped this kid and took $350 to keep the party going, right? The idea was the kid sold vape and pot with his older cousin. The $300 was nobody's going to report them, right? Right? So I don't know if anybody watches The Wire, but I guess they thought they were Omar from The Wire, right? Nobody's going to report them. So sure enough, they take the money, and you know, it turned into a shit show. But they got sentenced for a felony, so they were put away. They were at a group home outside of Pittsburgh for 6 months. And you know, listen, I did not act perfectly during all that craziness. But I'll tell you what, I'd be totally okay if somebody had a camera rolling the whole time in my house. Like I acted with as much dignity and grace as humanly possible during that. Not perfect, but like literally, I'm okay with that. And it carried me through, you know, and other things carried me through. And I was able to go see them and, right, say the change of heart prayer, the sick man prayer, all the way there. Right? Because guess what? I was just like them, right? Like I was just like them. If I had a beer in me, I wasn't coming home, right? Like I wasn't coming home. Like when I was 14, I used to sleep. I don't know why, but I used to pass out on this little church lawn down the street from me when I was in my teenage years. And it must be some sick psychological thing because we didn't even hang out there. Like we played sports on it when we were really, really little. And literally, if you couldn't find me at dinner time, my mom would send my younger brother down, go see if he's sleeping in the bushes, right? So, like, I wouldn't come home. And that's what they did. And I could be that same person, you know? And then on the flip side, that daughter of mine, who I used to walk over as a five-year-old, got married in August, right? And I was able to show up a sober man, right? I enjoyed the hell out of that day. I was totally joyous. I was totally neutral to alcohol, right? Believe it or not, I actually thought people were there to see her and not me. And, you know, I was able to do what I couldn't do at my brother's wedding, right? Because when I'm honest, I was afraid to make a toast at my brother's wedding. You know, I was able to enjoy that day. So that's another gift. I was totally, totally joyous. And then finally, my parents, married 65 years, together 68 years, you know, just a very good example of what a marriage should look like. My dad died 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, and my mom died 3 weeks later. And it was all good because they were 92 and 87, and we knew my mom was going to die. Like, we knew, right? So it was all good. But I was able to go and, you know, I was able to handle that, right? And they're all three of those. Like, I drank, right? I would have drank out of self-pity with what was going on for my boys. I definitely would have got jammed up with my role at my daughter's wedding, right? I would have just been so jammed up with my role. I would have went out, I would have got loaded, and they would not have been able to find me, right? And I would have ruined her wedding just like I ruined my brother. It would have been the same scenario. And then with my parents, you know, again, they're just all reasons for me to my history of drinking, all three of them would have been either game on then or game on afterwards. Like my parents, it probably would have been game on afterwards. I probably would have managed my pride and my image to get through the funeral, but afterwards I would have been gone. And you know, I was able to do it all with some grace and some dignity and as a sober man. You know, that's not me. I mean, that's my higher power. Right? When I got sober, I used to call my first sponsor and thank him for on my anniversary. That might be the only time I called him, so I call him and thank him and he used to always say, Steve, it's not me, it's you and God. And he was right, because at the time I was working again, I was back up in Bucks County, I was a bar drinker, so I could have drank anywhere I want. And I didn't. So it's been a crazy ride. We're coming up on time, and I think, you know, I guess the last thing is, they say this at my home, or the Saturday morning meeting all the time, right? Like, you hear all the time in AA, you know, you got to give it away to keep it, and they like to say you got to give it away to get it, and that's been my experience, right? Like, in order to me get some of this grace and some of this, right, what I'm looking for is permanent sobriety, right? Because I need something that gives me the ease and comfort that first drink does. And I want it to be permanent. I want it to be lasting. I want it to be, and my head wants to tell me it's the next relationship, right? When I realize that I got a spiritual malady, when I read I got a spiritual malady, and the only thing that's going to fix me is more spirituality, right? I read the only thing that's going to fix me is a date. I read the only thing that's going to fix me is a better job. I read that the only thing that's going to fix me is, you know, a bigger house. I'm a slow teacher. I had to learn the hard way. I had to go through a lot of pain to realize, you know, got to give it away to get it, not give it away to keep it. So I'll stop there. I did all right. Anybody?